Well, 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 you found your way back into the Last Video Store, the show where I, Alexi Toliopoulos, will talk to funny and cool and interesting people about their favorite films and movies. And we do that in the style of an old school video store rental combo, where I will give them a staff pick recommendation based on their taste. Now, we have been kicking off this new year, haven't we, Producer M? Rewinding and revisiting a bunch of our favorite episodes.
Yep.
And this was one that you suggested to me, and I thought, absolutely, we should re-release this one.
This was the one of the most exciting gets we've ever gotten.
I was glowing this whole interview. It's so funny. I almost don't know if I can re-listen to this one when we put it back out, because Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is the guest. Genius actor.
Mm-hmm.
Icon. Icon. Mm-hmm. Like, for people our age,
yeah.
I would say you cannot overstate how exciting this guy's career was at the exact time I was falling in love with movies.
Yeah.
From Bend It Like Beckham to the Tudors TV show, Velvet Goldmine, mm-hmm. Ride with the Devil, the Ang Lee film, Match Point.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, I honestly could keep going. And I was so excited to talk to him. And he adores film.
Yes.
And so when we were talking together, I don't know if I can listen to this episode, because I was like, did I say anything? Did I even talk? Because well, I just was in awe.
He did an amazing job of like giving us a lot.
Yes.
Because sometimes you don't know if someone's going to get the concept, mm-hmm. and talk about film, or, you know, are they just going to want to talk about the film they're promoting?
Yeah.
He wasn't even promoting anything. He just like came on.
He just wanted to come on.
Yeah. And so, and he did an amazing job at like talking about the films he picks, but also his own films, and giving us some amazing insights into what it was like working with some of the biggest directors and actors in Hollywood. It was awesome.
Oh, I just love this chat. And I think about this episode a lot, because in, amongst his picks, one of the films he picked, Andrei Rublev by Tarkovsky,
mm-hmm.
I had not seen before.
Yeah.
I say this to him on the episode, but it has not left my mind for over a year since recording it. I think about that movie every fucking day. Like, it is, it became one of the most important movies to me.
Yeah.
Just, I'm so grateful for Jonathan Rhys-Meyers doing my little show, mm-hmm. to have given me the gift of a film that I'm going to love for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. The recommender got a good recommendation.
Exactly. And I gave him a weird recommendation that I don't know if he will ever get to see, because I can't find this documentary anywhere anymore. But I really, really appreciate Jonathan Rhys-Meyers doing this show. He shared it quite a few times since, which has been very, very nice. But really, really generous, kind man. Put me on a bit of a Tarkovsky path, a bit of a path in reading Transcendental in Film by Paul Schrader. Great piece of criticism by Paul Schrader before he became a filmmaker. And just, I know, we really, really appreciate this chat. And I would say when I watched The Brutalist a year or so ago, when I was, I think the ending of that film is trying to achieve what Andrei Rublev does beautifully.
Interesting.
And so I remember I was so grateful that Jonathan put me onto Andrei Rublev before I saw The Brutalist. So that's been in my head. Love this episode. Thank you, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. I just wanted to put this one back out again.
I know, yes. I know.
Cool episode.
The audience loved it. Like, the audience loved it. And we had a bunch of Jonathan Rhys-Meyers fans, which there are a lot of, come and maybe just watch or listen to this one episode. But we appreciate that as well. Like,
well, listen again, guys.
Yeah,
it's back out
come
there.
Back.
But this is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, a titan of film. Great to talk to him. Just so erudite. I must just say another thing. No, it's maybe too crazy to say. If I say this, if I say something that's crazy, cut it out. But my partner is Irish, her family's Irish, and they're all, I think Irish people are some of the most exciting intellectuals to talk to in the world. And when I was talking to Jonathan, I was like, wow, this is like what it's like. Cut that out. No way.
I'm keeping that
actually.
In.
That was insane to say.
No, you love Irish people.
I love Irish people. Yeah. Yeah, Irish people are my people. So it's just like, I don't know. It was very nice to share it with Jonathan.
Okay.
So enjoy
this
episode.
You heard it here first. Alexi loves Irish people.
I love the Irish. But check out my podcast, Last Video Store, I was going to say. Check out my live show. I'm touring comedy festivals around Australia this year. It's called VHS. Tickets are in the show notes. I'm coming to a city near you, I'm sure. So check it out. If you like hearing me talk about movies, that's what I'm doing on that show. But it'll probably be funnier than I am on this podcast sometimes. Especially on this episode where I barely talk because I'm so excited to be fucking in the presence of an actor that I adore. But listen to this episode. I love this one. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, thank you for entering this realm known as the Last Video Store.
Thank you very, very much. I always liked video stores. I spent a lot of time in them as a kid.
Well, can you tell me about the video store you grew up with then?
Well, in our country, of course, you had the version of Blockbuster, which was Extravision. So as a kid, even if you didn't want to rent a video at the time, you would find yourself just looking at the sleeves of videos for an awful long time. I did anyway, for whatever reason. I just had a pure boredom. But then I moved to the countryside and there was this little video store in our village. And I used to spend a lot of time going in there, chin wagging to the guy who's sitting behind the counter, you know, much like you're doing yourself.
Exactly. I'm glad to take you back to that memory almost exactly recreation.
You chat about films and you chat about life, and every so often I would rent one. And I remember I never rented the film at the time. I saw it when I was much older, but I was always fascinated with the box for the movie, Werner Herzog's movie, Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
The cover was just big Kinski face.
It was Kinski, but it was Kinski's face with the helmet on, and he's kind of looking up into the sky, and I thought, wow, it's a great cover, it's a great face and whatever. And I remember seeing the magnificent film much later, Aguirre sans Sugaten, and it was just, I remember that memory, I don't know why it's stuck in my head, but another memory I have for that particular video store was I used to drive a car. It was an atrocious banger. I mean, it really was. And I drove it for years, even after I started to make films. I mean, it was quite embarrassing to most people who got it, but I brought this car into the village to bring back a video to the video store, right? And this car was on its last legs. It's on its last legs before
its
I ever
final
sat
mission.
It. Yeah, this final mission. And so I brought it into the village to the video store, and the fucking engine blew up outside the video store. And everybody was rushing out of the pub with like fire extinguishers and such. And all I wanted was to grab the video. Because videos at that time cost $100 for them to buy it, and then they would rent it out for whatever. And I'm like, they're gonna fucking catch me for the $100. The $100 video was worth way more than the car. So yeah, there we go.
Wow, that's a beautiful video story. Well, you know, we will not charge you any late fees here.
Thank you very much.
No late fee for you, because especially if you went on that mission, you know, you're destroying your own car in front of the video store. I go, that is a true cinephile. That is someone that we respect in here.
Yeah, no. It's just the film was like.
Do you remember the
sport? It was the film that I was giving back.
Oh, now I would say that's worth at least $200. One of the great video store films is Bloodsport.
Bloodsport, yeah.
And
Jean-Claude Van Damme, wasn't it Bloodsport?
That's him indeed. One of the great martial art tournament films, if not the greatest martial arts tournament film there is.
It was great, yeah.
I will say this, Jonathan. You have a rare honor right now sitting in this chair. You are our first guest to come into the show that has had one of their films picked as an all-time favorite by previous guests.
Oh, really? Wow.
Bend It Like Beckham was chosen by Eloise Efthos.
Okay.
One of the best comedians in Australia.
All right.
And I would say one of my favorite movies as well growing up. Do you have any, like, how did that film change, or what did you learn from that film about screen acting that you carry with you today still?
You know, I didn't want to do the film.
Really?
I read the script for Bend It Like Beckham, and I didn't want to do it. And I remember being in a hotel called Hazlitt's, which is in Frith Street in London. Hazlitt's is an extraordinary little boutique hotel that used to be the home of the essayist William Hazlitt. And so, but now they've turned it into a boutique hotel where they have particular rooms of particular writers who stay there throughout time. I like to stay there. It was recommended to me by another actor called Rupert Everett. Mm-hmm. He said, stay here. So great I was staying there. Well. Wonderful actor.
Great actor.
We did Bee Monkey together years ago. Not the world's greatest film, but the world. Wonderful director, Mike Radford, and wonderful cast, and Rupert, Jared Harris, brilliant.
Great.
But so I remember being on the phone, lying on the bed in a room called the Prussian Resident. That was the name of the room. And I'm lying there and I'm like, you know, we have notions when we're young actors thinking we're above ourselves, you know. So I'm on the phone to my brother and I'm like, yeah, I auditioned for this movie called Bend It Like Beckham, but I am fucked if I'm going to do a film with Beckham in the title. I feel like such a dickhead, like sort of bandwagging on someone else's name. And he said, explain it to me. So I explained it to him. And he said at the end of the conversation, it took about 10 minutes to explain the movie. He said, Johnny, you have to do it. He goes, you have to do it. He goes, that's the type of film that people kind of want to see. And I'm like, I know, but like, I'm not a soccer coach. And yeah, I can play it. And he's like, it's not the point. That is not the point of this film. So he could see what I couldn't see. So I went and I made the film with Gurinder and all these lovely people, Arshi Punjabi, Keira Knightley. Oh my God, Keira Knightley. I remember the first day I saw Keira Knightley on a football field in Slough, outside of London. Slough. Nobody wants to go to Slough for anything, but we went there for our training sessions. Have you seen the TV show Slow Horses?
Oh, I just started watching it.
Yeah, Gary Oldman. So they send them to Slough House, because nobody wants to go to Slough for any reason.
Very inconspicuous there.
Kind of like weird. Yeah, Slough has got this thing. I think that's also, Slough is where
The Office is set,
The Office is set in an office block in Slough. So that's what, nobody wants to go there. So anyway, I was there in Slough on the football field training for Bend It Like Beckham. And one day, this girl, young girl, tumbled out of this van with all her school books dropping on the floor. And I remember picking up all these school books dropping on the floor. And this girl stood up and I thought, wow, she was so beautiful in almost magical sort of, you know, 50s film way, you know.
Movie
and I
star.
Thought, just movie star. Mm. She was only 16 years old at the time doing her last exams. But you could see that, you know, all of this was there.
The presence was there.
All of this was there, yeah.
Oh, far out.
So I remember seeing that, and it was quite extraordinary to see that 16-year-old girl, you know. The next thing she did was Pirates. So it was kind of like, it was extraordinary to be in there in that moment. Perminda Nagra, who's such an accomplished actress, and actually was the girl who played Jess, was actually older than all of us.
Really?
She was 28 when she made the film, or 29 or something like that. She just looks so
convincing,
young.
Convincingly
young
well.
Girl. And then, of course, Archie Punjabi, the wonderful Archie Punjabi, who played her older sister, and Anupam Kher, who played the father, who's incredibly famous in India. Yeah. He's like one of these
Lagan,
most famous
right?
actors. Yeah,
one of the biggest films.
One of the biggest films. It all turned out rather splendidly. Juliet Stevenson giving a wonderful performance as the mother, and Frank Farmer as the farmer. Wow. I don't know, it all worked out beautifully. Gurinda did incredibly well out of it, but deservedly so.
Yeah, deservedly so. I think one of those defining movies for me growing up. And if I could permission to geek out with you a little bit longer here, because when I was working in the video stores was kind of like that late 2000s era when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And so many of your movies were just the films that really connected with me that I think defined so much of that era, from Match Point to I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. I absolutely love I'll Sleep When I'm Dead.
I really liked making that movie. You know, I really, really loved making that film. An extraordinary director. An extraordinary cast of people. I remember doing the there's a male rape scene in it with Malcolm McDowell, and you know he was because Mike Hodges, the director, had a relationship obviously with
that kind of crime genre as well,
because he'd made Get Carter and stuff like that. So I remember when I was doing the scene, and Michael McDowell's really funny, he's Manchester, you know, so he's got a lot of gear, kids, you know. And so he's dressed in the bow tie and stuff like that, and he's got me bent over, and he's like, he's turning to Mike the director, and he's like, hey Mike, do you want me to like spread the cheeks here a little bit? And I was like, obviously I'm not feeling the May West, because I'm the one that's bent over the tires.
Yeah.
And And he comes out and he whispers to me just before the take. He goes, "Hey, you lucky kid, this was almost Michael Caine, kid. You know how method it would have got if it was Michael Caine?" I was a kid. Outrageous behavior. Yeah. Outrageous behavior. But I loved making the film. It was a really, really interesting time in Brixton, South London, with Jamie Foreman, the wonderful Clive Owen. The extraordinary Mike Hodges. And Malcolm McDowell and the incredibly beautiful Charlotte Rampling. Wow. Yeah. And to spend any time in her company.
Yeah, of course.
It was a good thing.
And I think making a Mike Hodges film for you at that time must have felt like that ascension moment, right? Like being in a classic kind of geezer gangster film or that kind of crime genre.
You know, he had this extraordinary, I had an extraordinary grandfather quality with him. You know, I really liked him. I liked everything about him. I liked his approach. I liked the fact that he lived in Devon and he pruned his roses. And he liked to make these type of films, film in that type of world, a classic style maybe. And I love the fact that he'd made Flash Gordon.
A real journeyman type filmmaker. You know, you think of his crime films, then you go
from Get Carter to Flash Gordon. It's alive! Flash is alive with Brian Blessed. Oh my God. And I even got to spend some time with Brian Blessed in my life. He's another like extraordinary character.
Yeah. When I think about that era as well, a film that I think persists and continues to form really deep bonds with lovers of film. I think even deeper as it goes on with generation to generation is Velvet Goldmine.
Yes.
Can you tell me about I truly think there's something special about that film. I rewatched it like by chance not too long ago. And my thought was, I think even in 50 years' time, this will become an even more special film for generations ahead. And talking to younger people about that film, it deeply connects with them. How does that film play with you now? How does it connect with you now?
I haven't seen it for many years, but it's a film that's almost ahead of its time.
I think it is ahead
while,
of its time.
While it was making a film about glam rock, which was obviously in the past, but Todd has that clever thing because he's an extraordinarily intelligent man and a wonderful filmmaker and a wonderful person, by the way. As is Christine Vachon, who's producing. But he did the smart thing that all people who are doing films that are based in a very predominant historical era is to put yourself in history and look forward. Don't look back at history. You've got to place yourself in history because people are always looking forward. These guys were always about the future and what was modern and what was futuristic and what was contemporary and what was now. That's what was important. Instead of looking back in an almost fucking sepia sentimental view of it.
Yeah. You know,
it bores the shit out of most people. But also this kind of like weird sort of like magical, almost like odysseical like journey that Christian Bale's character, who is the root character of Velvet Goldmine, he is the observer, the chronicler of this story. People come in and out of it, obviously. You know, Brian Slade is just a vision of a pop star at that time. But it's Christian Bale that anchors it. Christian Bale is Todd. So that's the closest connection to the filmmaker.
Yeah.
He was the POV, you know? And then the scenes with you and then the person who was observing this reality or this illusion of what reality is and being entranced in it and fantasized by it finally gets to devour it in the character of Ewan McGregor on the rooftops and stuff like that. And so it's that weird journey of do you really want to meet the people that you idolized for so long? And how it was sort of like that 1980s New York had become very, very dystopian, which it had, Fear City at that time, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, no. Todd's one of the best filmmakers in the world. He is one of the best. I was so lucky, even though I don't think I appreciated just how lucky or how fortunate I was at that particular time. And there's things about the character that I would certainly have done very differently today. But it's a lot of people like the film, and Scorsese definitely liked the film. Yeah. We got an award at Cannes, but I knew that because Scorsese was like, I'd really like to give it the bomb door, maybe. Yeah. You know, but he really liked it, and you know, it's like.
In that respect, with the point of view entry, does that affect your performance at all, or how you kind of calibrate the performance? Were you trying to create something to as how the Christian Bale character sees that character, or how were you calibrating that?
No. I was trying to sort of like imagine that I was just the most fabulous thing that ever fucking put on a pair of platforms. So it was kind of like, this is, you know, that's kind of like what you kind of have to believe. But I was just. Yeah, I was engaging in that. So I had notions, brother. I had notions above my station.
We had some notions.
I had notions about what was going to happen or who I was going to be. Say so they quickly got, you know, that balloon got bricked pretty
quickly. You study Bowie at all for that performance? I
started, and then, you know, we were going to use Bowie's music, and Bowie decided that he didn't particularly want the music to be used in this production. So then I had to change it into something else.
Your own creation.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was very, when it was on the Bowie thing, all I had to do was kind of like take the bits of Bowie and then apply them to myself. But then when Bowie's music wasn't being used, we had to do things like change the hair color from red to blue, which was different, you know, and then it makes him something different. Mm. So then I had to kind of make him sort of a little bit Bowie, a little bit Brian Eno, maybe, you know. That sort of thing, sort of like start taking it from different people.
And a little bit of Jonathan as well?
Obviously, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, at that time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you know, just, because at that time, because of where we were in the world, myself, Toni Collette, extraordinary actress, Christian, Hugh McGregor, Michael Stipe producing it, Jesus Baby, you know, and, you know, I Can Have a Gay Day is easier than the next guy, you know what I mean? So we really got into it, you know? We were all walking around. I mean, it's for that period of time in London, I mean, we did, to a certain extent at that time, kind of like run amok. For like the 10 weeks that we shot in London, I mean, every night was fabulous dinners with lipstick, bows and tafts. I mean, it really kind of was that way.
Of course,
we lived the experience, the whole lot of us. And it was kind of like, we kind of tried to create that world as much as possible within all of us. So, you know, for 10 weeks, we all walked around like we were impossibly fucking entitled. You know, sort of.
It enhances every moment, right?
We're fabulous. I mean, it's like, I've never, you know, you just, and that's the kind of image that you have to mythologize yourself as an actor, you know, beyond, you know, exceeding your own grasp of what you are. If you're standing there doing a photo shoot, don't look at the monitor of what's being shot or anything like that. You've got to stand there. And even if it is, in fact, you've got to believe you're just the most gorgeous thing that ever happened. Why wouldn't anybody just want to sit and look at you all day?
Wow.
And that's the kind of mythology you've got to get into your head, especially as an actor in the audition process. You're sitting in a room with tons of guys that are all going to be there. And from your perspective, because you're comparing your truth to their lie, by the way, they're all incredibly fabulous. So you've got to mythologize to be able to convince the people who have the jobs to give that, you know, never mind these guys. You could go with these guys, but you'd be losing.
Yeah. Well, you know, my audition experience is a little different. It's usually a lot of chubby guys, a lot of glasses, a lot of slouchy guys.
Really?
But yeah, no, I'm more gorgeous than all of them. I can feel that much. It's maybe even easier for me to feel that.
But that's kind of what you have. That's the fantasy things you have to play in your head.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's not true. There's always somebody better and more brilliant than you are. Yeah. That's fact of life. There's always somebody else coming up. There's always somebody who's just a couple of years younger, a couple of inches taller.
God, a couple of inches hairline taller. Slightly that once in my head of mine, you know?
Piss on them. Yes. Piss on them.
Okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to piss on those guys. I'm going to piss on all of them. Maybe a little extra. We'll see how we go.
Or maybe a little extra, depending on what we have to offer.
Well, Jonathan, it's been a joy talking to you about your movies. But I'd love to talk to you about some of your favorite films. We're going to send you out into the store. We're going to pick out a new release film, a couple of weekly classics, and we'll talk about them. And then the honor shall be upon me. I'm going to, you know, perhaps try to piss out my own staff pick recommendation for you based on your tastes.
Okay, fantastic.
So we'll see how we go. And, well, you know, the pressure will be on. The pressure will be on
for
me.
The pressure is on. I'm getting prepared.
Yes. And I will allow you to piss on me if I do not pick you a good one.
I think that might be a little unethical.
Well, you know, ethics out the window today, Jonathan. Ethics out the window.
Okay.
New release.
man, this is so great. This is a ball, dude.
Thank you. And it was a real pleasure.
All right, we're going to talk about your new release film. This is, I think, one of the best satires in the last couple of years. From our comedy section, we have got American Fiction.
Yes.
Comedy.
I'm really excited to see you pick this one out because I remember you started with Jeffrey Wright in a great film, Ang Lee's Ride of the Devil.
Yes.
What was it like working with Jeffrey Wright? Has he had an impact on you? Is that why you chose this film?
I think Jeffrey Wright, without knowing it, has had a bigger impact on my career than any other actor that I've ever worked with.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
I was doing a film. First of all, I liked him immensely from the moment I met him. I thought, here is a really, really intelligent artist beyond being an actor, an artist on a different level. Mm. Complicated, but brilliant. And I just liked being around him. I loved observing him, observing what he did. We used to talk. I obviously, and also I wasn't an American, so I didn't come with
the baggage, with
American baggage at all. So I had a very, very free sort of world view, European view of the world and that time period. I know way more about the Civil War than I should. For some reason, I got very interested. So I had a really good knowledge, and his character has a very different experience for everybody else in the American Civil War, being the only predominant black character in it.
Mm.
So I was really interested to be around him. And then I had to shoot a scene during the sacking of Lawrence, Kansas, with himself and Tobey Maguire, and they're in a cafe, and I have a scene. And I remember rehearsing the scene. And I rehearsed it, and I read the lines or whatever, and we blocked the scene. And then I pissed off to have a cigarette and a cup of tea or whatever. And Jeffrey came over to me, and he said, hey, man, can I talk to you for a moment? I said, yeah, sure, Jeff, anything you want. And he says, I don't want you to take this the wrong way. And I was like, no, I'm not going to take anything wrong away from you. But he goes, I think there's something more in your dialogue than is coming out. And I'm not quite sure would Jeffrey have done this with any of the other actors, but I think he understood with me that I had the humility to open my fucking ears, put the cotton wool into my mouth for a second and listen to what he had to say. And he explained something about the scene to me that I hadn't seen. And so I looked at it and I said, wow. And he said, I'm just saying, I thanked him. And then I did exactly what he told me to do, the way he told me to do it, how to look at it. And from that little 2 minute aside, that he took the time and care to be able to give another actor a heads up that would take them through their career. And I was forever grateful for it. And that's a real artist.
That's so valuable.
In that world of young actors, everybody's competitive. Everybody's it's a me world. I understood it. And I was grateful that I myself had the fucking humility to shut up at that time, which was exactly what I should do, and listen to a more accomplished actor give you a really, really good lesson, free of charge and with an open heart, and he did that. And so I really appreciated that. And then I'd seen him, obviously, throughout the years, him doing wonderful work. And then I saw American Fiction. I haven't really liked too many films for the last few years, but American Fiction was one of them.
What was it that connected to you about this film exactly?
Well, first of all, I wanted to see what Jeffrey was going to do with it.
And it's a fantastic performance by him in this film.
Magnificent performance. He plays Monk so well with that sort of his intelligence, obviously. It's obvious from the beginning, but you can understand the being jaded with a business, being jaded with the mask, presumption and assumption being the mother of all fuck-ups, and I constantly have to do this. And, and it also shows a part of American society that we are, we as audiences are not have not been introduced to in a way before. Mm. And that's sort of like East Coast intellectual black family, it was very, very telling, how the difference in culture is obviously there, but it's an American culture.
Yeah. And it's also...
And it's pure Americana.
Pure Americana.
In a different way than you've seen pure Americana before. And the scenes... And Jeffrey Wright is magnificent in it. Tracy Ellis Ross, magnificent. Mm-hmm. Issa Rae is magnificent. But what Sterling K. Brown in that film amounts to fucking grand larceny. He stole just about every scene he was in. Absolutely. He was stunning. Stunning. He was so good in it. So fluid. So handsome.
And it utilizes the power of his voice so well to like kind of enhance who that character is, because his voice is so strong, so rich, so he's got that great cadence as well, the way words kind of slip out of his mouth.
And that great smile as well, that disarming smile that he has. But also there's a frailty, vulnerability to him, a lost vulnerability where he can de-age himself in a moment. I love actors who can age and de-age themselves at will.
Famously Al Pacino in The Irishman. Why, there's someone else who de-aged him.
Without the physical de-aging, I'm talking about being able to just de-age yourself in the manner of
in the moments,
exactly where you are.
Yeah.
How to bring the wounded little boy out, and he did it beautifully, knowing that there's a very fierce man behind this as well. An extraordinary performance. But you see, then all of this is held together by Cord Jefferson.
Yeah.
And you see, the thing is, I'm an actor in films, filmmaking and TV. This is a director's medium, mm-hmm. and a director of photography's medium, and an editor's medium. To a certain extent, it's a writer's medium as well. But writing for cinema and writing novels, not the same thing. It's not literature. It's a blueprint for something that will then be presented in a series of images.
The script is never the final draft of a film.
Well, it isn't, because it has to take place. It has to be manifested into something else. So I love the intelligence of Cord Jefferson's filmmaking. I love the way he was able to allow scenes to play themselves, how he presented the family, how the actors presented the characters they were playing. John Ortiz is always wonderful in almost everything he does. I've seen him in something recently, again, that I loved, a film that kind of went under the radar but shouldn't have gone under the radar because the performances are so outstanding, is a film called The Drop.
With Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy.
I love that film. James Gandolfini, one of his last films. Great, great, great crime film.
American noir.
American noir.
Wonderful, in the most wonderful sense. And had it got like... And
it's great, like almost confines itself to like a block. Like it just is so minute the way that it kind of captures this specific vibe. Great film.
Yeah, it's like it's something that maybe Alan J. Pakula would have directed, you know, or... there's many other directors that could have directed, but it had that kind of like, late 70s, early 80s mm-hmm. American film feel.
Like it reminded me of Straight Time, that Dustin Hoffman film.
There you go.
Ulu Grosbard, I think, directed that film.
Okay.
It has that kind of like that really nice, grimy crime film that has this certain specificity to it. And I just love the way they use the word like American noir. Like there's something, it's like that East Coast noir feeling.
Yes.
That's very different to like the Hollywood noirs. It just captures that vibe and great Tom Hardy performance. I think it was the first time I saw Matthias Schoenaerts was in that film as well.
Yeah, Matthias Schoenaerts, plays the bad guy, plastic gangster. I mean, obviously, I think Tom Hardy's given some wonderful performances. I think that is about the best I've ever seen him.
I must agree with you.
I think it's probably about the best I've ever seen him.
Yeah.
He had a, I don't know, there was like a, I've seen certain performances that were good. For me, that performance that he did in The Drop was on par with Marlon Brando's in On the Waterfront.
Mm. Yeah.
He had so much of that about him. The vulnerability.
But the vulnerability of a tough guy that has to be tough on the exterior. There's nothing like it.
Well, it is, but but what you get out of him is he brings all of that Lev Mishkin, Dostoevsky's the idiot.
Yeah.
But be careful. Be careful when you like, and that John Ortiz says in that great scene at the end of it, nobody sees you coming, do they, Tommy? Nobody sees you coming.
And a great
performance. And that's what makes you so dangerous.
Yeah.
Nobody ever sees you coming.
Yeah.
And that's a true gangster, of course.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Great recommendation off the back of that as well. That's like such an underseen movie. Love that film. Another
so go watch American Fiction and the Drop, people.
We got two recommendations in one. Any other thoughts on American Fiction before we move on to your weekly choices?
Yeah, they should go and watch it. Feast on the great performances, you know, because they're there. The beautiful writing, the high level of emotional intelligence, and the wonderful filmmaking from a young director who's going to be hopefully making films for decades.
I hope so. I think it's also a great way of utilizing like its political thematics of like in the literature world and adding emotional stakes to them, which is just, it does that so magnificently.
But it didn't fire it at me like it was a canon. It presented it me in a way.
It's all through character.
It presented it in a way it was like a... Yeah, it's you know, I am not choking on the rhetoric of the film at all. I'm just enjoying it. I'm enjoying seeing that part. I don't see it too often. And when I do see it, I like it.
Elegantly didactic.
Quite.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to your weekly choices.
Weekly.
Mm-hmm. Where should we go first? Should we go to science fiction aisle or should we go the art house aisle? Where do you want to go down?
Oh, let's go science fiction. Let's keep the kids interested.
Let's do it. We're going to talk about, I would say, one of the closest to perfect films that has ever been released.
True.
It is 1979's, from the twisted mind of Ridley Scott, it is Alien.
Yes.
Sci-fi. Now, this is an all-timer.
Yeah, Alien is probably the best horror film and science fiction film ever made. For me, everybody's got a particular taste. But what he did with it, the extraordinary performances, the extraordinary sense of filmmaking skill, and a great team. Remember, he also had a great team in the acting world. Mm-hmm. And I always adore films. I don't always adore films with this, but yeah. I predominantly love filmmakers that have strong female characters. Mm. And Ridley's one of them. He makes great, strong female characters. And I love that in filmmaker. I find strong female characters infinitely more fascinating than strong male ones, but that's me. So the fact that Sigourney Weaver carried this powerful, beautiful, intelligent, sexy woman, but fierce, and that, you know, that thin line between absolute feminist beauty and pure masculine strength and will to live and survive. She has these in bucket loads. Ian Holm bringing this wonderful, very highly trained thespian actor in. John Hurt, the very same, who was just cracking out performance after performance in the 70s and 80s up to the mid 80s. You know, Midnight Express, 1984, 10 Rillington Place, Alien. He just couldn't stop him. And everybody bringing their influential A game to it. But then you have the added element of H.R. Giger, the great Swiss artist, creating the most elemental, fearful ghost, fearful monster that was ever put on cinema screens.
It's primal.
The alien is everything we dread. Mm-hmm. Hyper intelligent, because it's a mixture, has our genetics in it. When you get this from the film Prometheus, how our genetic age infected how the alien is born. So it has all of that high emotional intelligence with a fierce, almost perfect will to live, the perfect killing machine. Even its blood is acid. How it looked. And this H.R. Giger had a way of marrying the mechanical and the biomechanical together in such a way that it really hit on our greatest fears. And then how Ridley depicted space and the openness of it. You know, the concept of, you know, we look up at the stars and you see the Milky Way. On a really, really bright night, you can see the Milky Way galaxy. And we can see it all in the sky from one end to the other. But it's 7 trillion kilometers from one end to the other. Mm. So what I felt in Alien was really gave you such an idea of the vastness of space, the vastness of what people were actually doing there, and the cold loneliness of it. And how in the end, Sigourney Weaver escapes, but escapes into nothingness. It's not on you catch it up in James Cameron's Alien 2. Do you realize that it was 56 years before she was found? So it's into this vast nothingness, this almost you know, black hole element, you know. It's just, I even saw recently, and I'm not talking like a few years, I'm talking a couple of months ago, and it frightened me so much. I had a real sense of palpable fear. And this isn't a filmmaker at the height of his powers, you know. And I like Ridley Scott's one of those few filmmakers that just, he hits it straight out of the park straight away, you know. I mean, his debut film,
The Duelist,
is just, I mean, great source material. Joseph Conrad's book is extraordinary, but the things he was able to do with it.
He injects so much humor into it, is what I discover when I revisit it. I go, like, this is such a unique blend of feelings, that film.
His views of, you know, film fashion and you know, he's really has a great love of art and classical art, and you can see this in The Duelists. But you could also see it in the way he paints the pictures and holds the tension, especially the tension where Harry Dean Stanton's looking for the fucking cat. You know, it's just, I wanted the scene to end. I wanted the scene, it was so horrible. You kind of, you know what's coming. And I love the fact that in Ridley Scott's films, everybody on the spaceship smokes. Mm-hmm. Which I fucking love about Ridley Scott's films. And I love that there's always kind of like, you know, one of these really kitsch sort of swinging toys. If you look in Alien and Prometheus and all the, there's always this kind of really naff kitsch toy that kind of springs from side to side. You know, it's something that really shouldn't be there, but it's there. And I understand why.
It brings that kind of authenticity. It gets you to relate back to those moments.
It's
yourself.
Absurdity.
Yeah.
It's absurd. You kind of go, oh wow, I've got one of those in my car. What the fuck? Just those moments. He's a great director. And Alien, if you haven't seen it, my brother, I found out recently, he came to visit me. I live in a farm in Ireland, and my brother came to stay with me for a few days, and he'd never seen Alien.
Oh my god.
And I was like, you lucky bastard. I got so, I was so envious.
The grand honor you had.
That you've never seen it. And you have all of this. You have two of the most frightening and interesting hours to spend in that world. That's never been able to be recaptured. Nothing's been able to recapture quite the fear that he brought in. I mean, obviously, I'd seen it much later in life. It must have been an extraordinary film to see in 1979.
When did you see it for the first time?
1990, I was 13 years old.
Yeah.
So it would have been a good 10, 11 years after it was first released.
And did it hit you straight away? Was it one of those films that just,
no,
you felt it?
I saw it once, but I saw it with a group of people and everybody's talking over everybody else, you know, the usual thing. And then I sat down and watched it by myself. And I think it's one of those films where you have to sit down and devour it, of almost like a meditation. It's a lesson in filmmaking. It's a lesson in storytelling. When I watched it by myself, for myself, I took in every single moment and felt every little bit of frustration and fear. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautifully put.
Great filmmakers do this to you.
Truly. Mm-hmm. And I think he has such a great way of world building, the way he invites you into the world. Like, it's a very slow process. And I think Alien is the one that is so key to understanding that. Like, it's almost lonely the way you're brought into that world.
Sure. And he creates these worlds so good. He had an extraordinary team as well.
Yeah.
Was it Dante Spinotti or something? Is the production designer?
I think that sounds right. Let me double check for you.
I think it almost
I think it sounds right. Dante, I mean, it Spinotti. Feels like that era has to be him. Yeah. Production designer. Oh, Michael Seymour?
Michael Seymour.
Michael Seymour, who also did, that's probably his biggest film, Revenge, with Tony Scott as well.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he had an extraordinary team. Whoever was on the team is extraordinary, and I'm sure it was a team of very, very many movies. And you see, the thing is, that's making films. Mm. Ridley Scott is a great filmmaker, and H.R. Giger is a great artist, and the actor's a great actress. The DP is a great DP. But there is an entire crew of people that do extraordinary things and extraordinary work. And let me tell you, without them, you're not going to get those films. You're simply not going to get those films. It is a city of moving parts, filmmaking. It's a city of moving parts. And it is an extraordinary experience where everything has to come together. Jobs that have absolutely nothing to do with each other, but one job is essential to the success of another. Mm. So it's an incredible amount of teamwork and learning how to exist in a very high tension environment and still maintain a sense of artistry and humanity with people and such. You know, it's an extraordinary making a film is quite extraordinary. In one way, it's almost like going to war.
Yeah.
You know, and you do get as close to the people on film sets as you are going. You're going to share experiences with them that will never be recaptured.
Yeah.
You know? And you're going to enter into different, as an actor, I've entered into different phases of life, worn many different costumes from many different parts of history and many different parts of the world. So you get to get a sense of being part of it, being part of that history, even though it's an illusion, obviously. My job is to buy into that illusion so 100%. That I don't feel foolish. Because if you're running around in a fucking costume in the middle of the desert in 2023 and you're meant to be in the 9th century BC, mm-hmm. you're going to feel a little bit foolish if you don't completely believe in
if
it.
If you don't buy in all the way.
You've got to buy, man. Yeah. You've got to buy into it. And then you've got to take the criticism when it comes or, you know. Yeah.
And you pissed on all those guys at the audition to get this. So you may as well buy all the way in.
Well, yeah, sometimes you did, sometimes you didn't, sometimes you were just cheaper.
Can I tell you how I first saw Alien for the first time? Because mm-hmm. I would have been like you. I was 13 years old when I saw the film. And obviously, it's a film that has a huge reputation. Like, it has a huge reputation by that point.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is one of those big ones. And the night before, I truly vividly remember going to the video store, borrowing it, put it in my Xbox, watching it on my bedroom wall because I had a projector back in that day. And I was a true cinephile from day one. And I remember being pretty bored by it. And it was only because I had seen Alien versus Predator the day before. And I go, wow, I got to see more of this shit. Watch Alien go, okay, not a little bit slow, a little bit slower than Alien versus Predator.
Yeah.
But now I say I've evolved. I would even say Alien is better than Alien versus Predator.
Much better.
And you can put that on the poster, on the re-release, anything like that. Alexi Toliopoulos says Alien is better, even better than Alien versus Predator.
I think Alien is better than probably most any other Alien film that's come out.
Now I would even say better than most movies, like maybe 90, 80% of films.
As I said, the best science fiction and the best horror films ever made combined into one thing. It's as frightening and visceral as life or death. And with the combination of a filmmaker like Ridley Scott, an artist like H.R. Giger, they were able to touch on the one thing that we fear most, what we don't know and what we can't understand. And he touched on this. He touched on this in such a clear and brilliant way with a clear and brilliant vision and a commercial smash as well, which also helps and really also has this great combination of making brilliant work that also makes a ton of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, that's a good guy to know.
I think that's so beautifully put. The next re-release should have both our quotes together. Me, better than Alien versus Predator. You saying, it's about the stuff we don't know, the fear that we don't know.
Yeah.
That's a great DVD that we'll have on the counter with those two there. Let us walk down that art house aisle and talk about your next film. Mm-hmm. The second film from Andrei Tarkovsky. Mm-hmm. Powerful, powerful film. Andrei Rublev from 1966. Because this film is loosely based on the life of Andrei Rublev, a medieval Russian painter of religious iconography, icons.
Yeah.
And Tarkovsky is one of my big blind spots. I've seen like Solaris, I've seen Stalker, I've seen Ivan the Terrible.
Ivan the Terrible is Sergei Eisenstein. Ivan's story.
Yeah, Ivan's childhood. I've seen that. Andrei Rublev had kind of like been elusive to me for some reason.
Sure.
It's been kind of hard to see in Australia for a while.
Yeah.
But seeing it come up in your stack, I was like, I got to get in on this. I got to finally watch this. Mm-hmm. This is one of the most incredibly powerful documents to faith that I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
This is one of those films that as soon as I gave myself to it, the way we've been talking about a lot of these films, as soon as I gave myself to it, its richness, it's every moment is rich with not just detail, but with every feeling of life. I think it's one of the greatest biographical films I've ever seen because it imbues it all together. Can you tell me about why you brought this film out, because I think it's just, it spoke to me so deeply this week.
Yeah, I mean, you said it pretty much. Andrei Rublev, especially for somebody, first of all, Andrei Rublev is, because I work in the industry, it means so much more to me. I look at that movie in the same way as I look at, great paintings from great painters. It's almost a spiritual experience watching the movie.
It truly is a spiritual experience.
And so you kind of go with him, and it takes all of those elements that have been used very successfully in many other great films, most predominantly Milos Forman's Amadeus.
Yeah.
And that's the Mozart-Salieri relationship. And that is the Andrea-Kirill relationship in this.
Mm-hmm.
And how the great painter who doesn't believe, I think in very many ways he's a great painter. He is more interested in his own spiritual soul development than he is about painting. Whereas Kirill wants affirmation. And so when he asked the great painters, Theosophanes?
Yeah, the painter. Theosophanes, the Greek painter he's. Yeah.
So when Kirill makes the deal with him that I will come and I will be your assistant, of course I will be your assistant, but you must come and ask me. And you must come and ask me in front of all the other monks.
Mm.
And that great scene where Theosophanes sends his messenger and the messenger asks for Andrei Rublev. You can see Kirill being so angry, and he walks away from the monastery. He's throwing all his things away, and he's abandoning God and abandoning all of this. But at the same time, when Andrei Rublev decides to go to Theosophanes, his best friend decides not to go with him.
Mm.
And in leaving him, and Andrei is like, oh, why won't you go? Because he did not ask for me. He asked for Andrei Rublev. So now Andrea realizes that to reach this spiritual thing, he must in some way, he must accept the road of being alone. He must accept the road of asceticism in many ways, to truly understand. To paint Christ, you have to walk as him, not be him. Don't play with God. But you need to know what it's like to walk a mile in those shoes, those very, very hard to wear shoes. And his desire for a connection with the young boy, and how he's desperate to save him almost from himself, from this environment, from this punishing world of backbreaking serfdom that he has to travel through. 15th century Russia was a difficult place to be.
Yeah.
And especially that scene. It's not a big scene in the movie, but it's kind of an aside where, the Tartars come and they start killing everyone. They start blinding all these people, right? But that's actually a true story taken from history, that there was one of these local lords, local, I suppose, miniature czars of their period, of their section, wherever they were. And he had this palace built by all these slaves. And so where he let them go, paid them and let them go. And as they were walking through the forest, he had his soldiers go and take the money back and blind them so they'd never build another place as beautiful as his.
Mm.
So it's the cruelty, the base cruelty of that world that he was able to portray in this sort of like painterly journey. It's another very sort of like Homeric Odysseus type journey through it. But starting off with Icarus.
Yeah. I mean,
so he starts off with it. So it opens with Icarus.
Yes.
And it's like, what happens when you try to reach the sun?
Mm-hmm.
This is what happens.
To reach the heavens, to reach the gods.
To reach the heavens, or to see as the gods may see.
Yes.
And you can see him when he's up there and he finally takes off. He goes, I'm blind. I can see it. But what he's actually seeing is what God is seeing. And that's why all the monks, and they're trying to get him down. How dare you be God? How dare you be God?
Yeah.
Don't try to be God. It's like,
okay.
And
I'm getting chills the way you're speaking about it. It's just like it's a film that I think the way you're talking about it is so perfect, because it's able to convey the feelings, because this film, it's such a perfect example of like the transcendental notion of cinema, where Tarkovsky gives you enough space to imbue your own thoughts and to kind of feel those resonance of life and to think deeper and to ponder and to philosophize yourself.
Sure.
And to me, where this really reaches its crescendo is not in the climaxes of the film, but it's like this artistic climax of the epilogue. The film's cut up into sections, like episodes of life of or chapters of life for Andre. And then that epilogue where the entire film has been in black and white to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the epilogue just being his artwork, like he's all you've seen the life of an artist.
Yeah.
And the last moments, you're left in the last minutes of this film with his art in full color.
Yeah.
And it's his art in the present day as yeah. it was filmed in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And I've never experienced something so emotionally powerful as that journey that takes you on and feeling who is the artist and now presenting you what is their art.
And the horse in the field.
And the horse in the field.
Alone, but at its most beautiful.
It's just
a simple horse in its field.
It's filmmaking in its most core symbols. Yeah. And it's because it gives you the space to feel.
Yeah.
It translates and transcends just powerfully in that nature of like slow cinema. Just, I think it's truly one of the best experiences I've had watching something. So forever in my life, I'm grateful for you for making me watch this film again.
It's one of the great films. And I was very lucky. I made a film with Andrea Konchalovsky, who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Called The Lion in Winter. It was a remake of the original with Glenn Close. Andrea Tarkovsky was born to make films the same way John Keats was born to be a poet.
Mm.
It was so natural for him to do so. Very few people have that naturality for filmmaking.
Yeah.
Stanley Kubrick, I think, as well. But Andrei Tarkovsky, in a different way, transcended film into being the highest level of art form while still maintaining the fact that it's a film telling a story and it's an entertainment. But for him, he was able to push that into just the upper echelons of... Yeah, it's a film, but it's a little bit more than that.
Mm.
It's a lesson,
yeah,
as well as a film, without ever trying to be a lesson.
It's never didactic. His films are never didactic.
It's like it's using pantomimes, I suppose, which films are, you know. I'm saying nothing, but I'm telling you everything.
That's it. I mean, that's it. That's the power of Tarkovsky as well. He's telling you everything. And visually, he's doing a lot, but it's also sparseness that does it. That's sparseness that tells the story, sparseness that connects. It's the true empathy of film. And he is able to capture that in a way that is so deeply spiritual.
Sure.
And I think for me as well, partly, you know, I'm Greek, Greek Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something in that imagery, in those moments of seeing those images of come to life at the end, come to life in full color.
Yeah.
It also grounds it in present day of going like, well, why does this person's life matter to you now?
Yeah.
And I think there's just something in that just, it's truly floored me, truly floored me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I was able to suggest. I'm always suggestive, never prescriptive, but I'm glad I was able to suggest something because it is quite an extraordinary experience to see that movie. And I watched that movie at least once a year.
Yeah.
At least once a year. And I think there are certain films that I watch over and over again. At least once a year, I will watch them. Kurosawa's The Seventh Samurai, Yojimbo, I'll watch those at least once a year. Tokyo Story, I'll watch at least once a year.
Those films that reinvigorate you. Like Tokyo Story, it's such a film about like what it is to be human, how it is to feel. And I think there's just something that's so enriching about the sadness and melancholy of that film. Sure. As well.
And you know, I have I've always been a fan of film from other countries because I think, and you know, it's obviously we live in a global world now. Mm. Oh, obviously we always lived in a global world, but now we actually know it's a global
world.
It feels global. It feels like everywhere is around the corner.
Yeah. Except for Australia. It's quite a long way. Yeah.
But still around the corner.
Yeah.
But at that time, seeing a film from a different world, like when I saw Satyajit Ray's The Music Room, which is just one of those great sort of films of a dying time, the end of the Raj, the end of, you know, it was just beautiful. The musical performances that will never be matched because these people don't exist and that culture almost has been wiped away from Bengal.
Panchali was that film for me as well of like just
Patha Panchali like, is a just, great movie.
Oh my gosh. Mm. It's dreamlike in how near realist it is. I go, sure. How do you do that? Sure. I don't know how you do that.
And I was lucky enough. I've been lucky enough to work with Meera Nayyar, one of the great mm-hmm. Indian filmmakers, and become friends. Although I never got to work with them. Obviously, I worked with Anubhav Kher, but Shekhar Kapoor. I spent a lot of time with Shekhar Kapoor while I was doing Velvet Goldmine. He used to come to my house and have dinner, and we used to have conversations. So they were mainly about Hinduism and Buddhist spirituality, and we both shared an intense love and admiration for Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the Qawwali singer from Pakistan.
Yeah.
Sufi. And so we used to sit and we used to have these conversations, and then he had this crazy idea, Shekhar, that he wanted me to be in his film Elizabeth, but he didn't want to write a character. He wanted me to play a kind of a court jester to Kate Blanchett's Elizabeth, and he could come in and out of any scene making any comment he wanted about people and stuff. And I think
a kind of fourth wall breaking thing.
And Shekhar Kapoor said it to the guys in working title, who just hit the roof. They were like, no way that's ever going to happen. And so instead of getting a gig on Elizabeth, I went to Tibet and Nepal on the recommendation of Shekhar Kapoor.
Well, it sounds like a film in and of itself.
Yeah, and his movie, The Bandit Queen, I remember seeing that at that time. That's another film you have to see about Phoolan Devi. It's so powerful, so powerful. Really, really great movie, great filmmaker. Anywho.
Staff pick. Yeah, well, now you've already given like a dozen recommendations just then.
Yeah, now I'm just going to go rent a video and piss off.
It adds more pressure onto me to give you that staff pick recommendation to chuck onto your pile.
Right.
And, you know, this is a hard one because I think you have such beautiful taste in film. You've explored a lot in film. So I kind of dug in different areas perhaps to kind of give you something you might not have seen before, might not have been on your radar. And I used Alien as the jumping off point.
Yeah.
And I think as well, it captures a little bit of that satirical humor of American fiction as well.
Yeah.
And I want to give you something that perhaps will give you some good humor, give you some lightness as well. Because I know you're working on a horror film or a psychological horror here in Australia. Yeah. Perhaps you need something to unwind with on your days off.
Yeah.
This is a documentary, in fact, called Alien on Stage by Danielle Kummer and Lucy Harvey.
Okay.
Documentary. Now, this has got one of the greatest taglines I've ever heard in a film. In Dorset, no one can hear you scream. And this is a film, a documentary about a crew of bus drivers in Dorset who every year they stage an amateur pantomime for Christmas. And one year they decide to adapt Alien for stage. And it becomes a bit of like a sensation. It's like these truly amateur actors and amateur theater practitioners, amateur dramaturges putting on this production of Alien, where they're all tested to their limits because, you know, these are untrained actors. They're having to kind of encapsulate the feeling of fear on stage, mm-hmm. but also has those pantomime qualities of capturing the audience's delight in all of it.
Yes.
And then it's also these amateur theatricians putting on, how do I make an alien? How do I translate Giga's work to just like an amateur stage production of Alien? And there's moments where they capture true ingenuity of like how they translate those, the way they translate the exoskeleton of the xenomorph and stuff, how they're able to do that. It's just spectacular. And it becomes like this, a bit of a sensation. And what happens instead is they get to do the show on the West End.
I'm almost sure that's how it ended up. I was just like, they had to have taken it on the road.
They took it on the road. They take it to the West End. And what really captured me about this film, like it has all of those films of kind of like your Christopher Guest films where it's an amateur production. There's some Love great little Guest. Moments captured on it and stuff.
Yeah.
But what really got me is there's a couple of moments that capture the genuine chill of live theater. Like there's a moment where the alien actually comes out on stage mm-hmm. and you're watching this at home and you know it's quite silly. It's like there's a humor to all of this.
Yeah.
There's that great like comedic gap of what the cast and characters are experiencing and what we as an audience see of them. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment where the alien comes out on stage and you feel a chill because you go, that's the power of live theater of just going, they're able to capture that moment. And even more so than that, it captures that rush of like, being backstage and hearing a huge roar of laughter from the audience while you're backstage and just going, peering through those curtains and going, okay, it's out there, made me miss those feelings greatly of that just while watching it. And it just is able to capture that feeling of live stage acting in an incredibly unique way, in an incredibly unique setting. So I really think that there's
Alien on stage.
Alien on stage.
I look forward to that.
I
haven't seen it and I'm looking forward to it. You've sold it quite well,
though. Yes. Okay, great. I live to see another day. I will not punish myself.
No. I think I'll enjoy it. And I do like it. I do enjoy those things. I think they did something recently where these amateur filmmakers over many years remade Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I saw that film at the same film festival I saw this one at. And it's I think it's called Raiders. It's a great film.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like, it's you know, you must as a filmmaker feel like you really did something special when a bunch of people will dedicate that much time to create an homage to you.
Yeah.
And what you've done, your filmmaking skills.
In the means that they have as well.
In the means that they have. And actually, it's the means that they have make it more special because they don't have money, so they have to throw brains. When you don't have money, you better have brains. that should be on the fucking poster of every film that ever comes out. If you don't have money, you better have brains.
They should tell you that at the day one of film school.
They do.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for jumping into the last video store with me.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
To your very beautiful store full and of your very beautiful
all my
cinematic treats.
All the treats are there. Can I ask you one last thing?
Yes.
You've got such a wonderful filmography. Is there one film that you think that you're especially proud of or connects with you still, with think about a lot that you think people should come pick up from the video store here? Any film of yours that you've made?
Yeah, I mean, obviously as an actor, you can promote your own films, but I think if anybody was to see a film that maybe they haven't seen, I made a film a few years ago with a wonderful actress called Vanessa Redgrave. Obviously, everybody knows Vanessa Redgrave. Mm-hmm. But she made one of the most extraordinary films I've ever seen with Ken Russell called The Devils.
The Devils.
And if you haven't seen The Devils, you've got to see her performance.
Incredible.
Which is done like this for the entire movie, which was extraordinarily physically demanding. Yeah. But Oliver Reed at the height of his powers.
Yeah.
And a great story, a true story as well, which makes it all the more magnificent to behold. No, Ken Russell's The Devils is definitely one of
them. And get your hands on the uncut version. It's out there. The uncut version of The Devils is true power, pure cinema. Like just
Saturday night in Ireland, babe.
Oh,
it's a Saturday night in Ireland.
I reckon if you go Andrei Rublev and then you watch The Devils right after, that's a very special day you've got.
Yeah,
very special day in religion for you. Well, thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you rock, so much.
Dude. This was such Alex, a pleasure and a joy.
Pleasure,
absolute pleasure. Pleasure and joy.
Okay, anytime.
Anytime, okay, we'll come back tomorrow.
The last video store.
So that was our chat with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Shit, dude. I love this episode.
Yeah.
I just really, really happy with it. Lovely, lovely to talk to Jonathan. Lovely to revisit it. I'm going to rewatch Andrei Rublev because I just got the Blu-ray from Criterion Collection in their more recent sale. So I want to dive into those special features as well.
Please.
Yeah. And I am just going to put this back out there. One of the things of re-releasing this episode to shine lights on the films that probably fell under the radar. Alien on Stage, a documentary that I mentioned in this as my recommendation to Jonathan. Great film. I don't know if it's gotten a release proper anywhere. And if you are in film distribution, I know people from DocPlay, Mad Men, Umbrella, a lot of great Australian distributors, listen to this podcast. Someone picked this film up. It is such a winner, this movie. I could see this playing really nicely in some small art house cinemas. Great, great documentary, Alien on Stage. Fucking pick it up, guys. I know you listen to this podcast, all the distributors.
Yeah.
Truly pick it up. I think this is such a good film. I could see it doing so well on a streaming service or in a little art house release if you want to pop it out. But definitely could go on a streamer. I love this movie, Alien on Stage. Filmmakers are really sweet. Put it out. Great film. That was my personal plea at the end of the Jonathan
Yeah, Smiles yeah, that's desperation in your voice.
I know, I just love this movie. And Jonathan will get to watch it if you put it on a streaming service. And that is the last video I saw this week. Hit us up on Last Video Store, but Tudor, or in the Spotify comments. I love reading Spotify comments for what you would recommend Jonathan on this episode. In the meantime, come check out my Comedy Festival tour, VHS. If you like hearing me talk about movies, that's what I'm going to be doing on that tour.
Cool.
And
imagine if you did a show not about movies.
I know.
Do you think you have a world?
Yeah, probably one. Oh, even like Finding Drago is about movies.
Yeah, it's all about movies.
I like foods. I'm interested in food as well.
I will not be producing that podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're talking about food.
You're vegan and I'm going to do a podcast where I slaughter a pig on stage.
Maybe the podcast is me forcing you to eat a bunch of vegan food.
That would be good because I do. I mean, Greek food is. This is an insane conversation having right now.
I think we're at too hot.
It's so hot. We're in the back room. There's no aircon.
I think
no
we need to cut. Okay, cut.
Oh, yes.
My God.
I do just start talking about vegan food. Anyway, guys, thanks for joining us. Happy New Year. Love you very much. Back with some new episodes a little later on in the year. Later on in the year, soon. I don't know why I didn't say soon.
Too hot.